Welcome, welcome everybody, as always, to our FOMC panel, this time for the month of July 2025. So everybody, if you've managed to keep up with the market, macroecon, geopolitics, congratulations to you this far this year. You're already more qualified for this panel than I am. We've got oil prices flirting with a breakout toward that $90 area again. Bond yields are seemingly undergoing an existential crisis. All the while, the Fed's cool while half the committee whispers of September and rate cut predictions get revised more often than the narrative around the Epstein's list. So as always, before we dive in deep, I'm going to break down who we've got speaking with us today, starting off, of course, with our incumbent Fed guy, Joseph Wang. As you all probably know by now, but if you don't, he headed the trading at the Fed's open markets desk and has a great introductory book on central banking that I like to plug every time because it's just that good, called Central Banking 101. And he's a CIO at Monetary Macro. Welcome back, Joseph. We got a big one.
Hey, Nicholas. Hey, Unusual Wells and everyone else. Thanks so much for inviting me. It's great to be here. And also, welcome, Adam. Look forward to hearing what you have to say. I've always learned a lot from his good posts on Twitter.
As do I. So we'll jump right over to Adam, too, there. Adam Ozimek, the Chief Economist at Economic Innovation Group, serving on the executive team and ever-growing font of research. He's also served as chief economist at Upwork, senior economist at Moody's, and his research, like Joseph said, has been cited nearly everywhere from the Wall Street Journal to the New York Times. Adam, always glad to have you here. Welcome back, man.
Thank you, Nicholas, and thank you, Joseph. Looking forward to having another great conversation, as we always do here.
Looking forward to it as well, Adam. Thank you. Next, we've got another repeat guest, another friend of the spaces, last bear standing, an expert on markets, and he writes about monetary policy and his picks that he's charted and researched moving forward in his weekly Substack. If you're not subscribed to that one, definitely go do it. A lot of good alpha coming out of Last Bear. Welcome back, man.
Thanks, guys. Thanks for having me. I do have some new technology today, so if my audio has any issues, please just give me a heads up.
Will do, but you sound beautiful for now. Next, we've got Bob Elliott, the CIO at Unlimited Funds, the former IC at Bridgewater, and also the PM of HFND. He always brings a ton of knowledge to these panels, a lot of good insights, a lot of good discourse, and he isn't as panic-driven as some of the folks we get to be lambasted with every day on Twitter. Always glad to have you, Bob. Welcome.
Hey, thanks so much for having me. Always great to join these spaces. And I love a few, at least new to me, voices here. So it'll be great to get them in the mix.
Yes, sir. This one's going to be huge, Bob. I'm excited. Next, we've got our volatility expert, Jem Carson, the founder of Kai Volatility. You know I always love to pick your brain, Jem, and I know you've always got a lot to say. Welcome back, man.
It's always great to be here, guys, with the new and to welcome the old and the new. So great to be here. And I think this is getting the Fed is more and more important to everything we do every minute here. Pretty interesting stuff going on in that world. Excited to talk about it.
Me too. And I've got a loaded smorgasbord for us today, and there isn't any ham on it, unfortunately, but I digress. Last but certainly not least, always love him having here too as well, Marko Bjekovic, the founder and CEO of Arkamina Research. He provides in-depth research on U.S. macro and the markets as a whole. Nearly two decades of experience working in the markets as an equity broker, investment advisor, manager, chief bank macro economist, you name it. Marco's got the forecasts and analysis that we all love to see as well. And Marko, I love having you here always. Welcome back.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here again.
And great to have you. So I'm going to go ahead and dive right in, folks, into this pool of what I hope is water and talk rate cuts right out of the gate today. CME FedWatch tool, which I know we have some discourse on as well, but nonetheless, the tool shows a nearly 0% chance of a rate cut at this week's FOMC meeting. But the market seems to be pricing in roughly 70% probability on a cut at the September meeting. And traders still seem to expect two cuts in total by the end of the year. Meanwhile, Governor Christopher Waller and Vice Chair Michelle Bowman have both publicly stated this week that they may dissent if the Fed doesn't deliver a 25 basis point cut in July. But it does seem very much like the consensus is no cuts yet. But what about the rest of the year, Joseph? What are your thoughts?
Well, first off, thanks so much for hosting the panel. So I think that the market, like you mentioned, prices in two cuts because that's kind of what the Fed guided towards on its dot plot. And like you mentioned, I think the most interesting thing today is that we might have two governor dissents on the board. Right now, the FOMC is basically divided into two camps. One much larger camp is thinking that, you know, we have a lot of things happening in the economy. These tariffs, they might show up in inflation later on in the year. So they like to wait and see for more data. But then you have, let's say, Governor Bowman and Governor Waller, maybe some other people, they have been very vocal, but probably not, are making the argument that we should be cutting rates today. And their argument is pretty reasonable. What Governor Waller is saying is that no tariffs, the way that he's looking at it, it's going to be a one-time change to the price level rather than change in inflation. And this is, to be clear, totally standard economic thinking when it comes to this. And in the past, Powell has also describe tariffs in this way. And so far, of course, looking over the past few months, you know, inflation, according to Governor Waller's calculations, if you take out the tariff effects, according to his models, we're basically at 2%. So he's pretty calm on inflation, but also getting a bit worried about the labor market, noting that, you know, the labor market on claims are high, new people trying to get a job having trouble. The unemployment rate for new grads is elevated. And so there are reason to be worried about potential cracks in the labor market. So that's his perspective. And today, maybe we'll hear how Chair Powell is going to resolve that, resolve the two camps, and how he thinks about the data that we've gotten in the intermediate period.
Thank you, Joseph. So I actually want to touch a little bit on employment here at the top, and then I want to kick it around the panel a little bit as well to get their kind of opening thoughts here. But Bob, this morning, actually, you tweeted a video discussing the low and stable unemployment numbers alongside the rising inflation. And you noted that the combination of the two more or less forces the Fed to do nothing despite other signs of economic drawdown. So kind of taking into frame of reference what Joseph said as well, Bob, can you break that down for us a little bit?
Well, I think one of the key things in terms of a frame of thinking is that the Fed is focused on making sure labor markets are tight, not strong. And those two words are usually very correlated to each other. But in an environment where you see a significant constraint in labor supply, those two points can diverge in the same way, to be clear, they diverged back roughly a year ago when we saw the unemployment rate rise predominantly due to a flood of new supply of labor. And so back then, the rate was rising, and therefore the Fed essentially was motivated to cut because they were worried about that continuing on. That was wrong, but that was the data that they saw. Here, we have essentially the exact opposite, which is, you know, they're going to end up running monetary policy that's tighter than what essentially would be appropriate if you were looking at the sort of total growth numbers in the economy, because the supply of labor is constraining, is making the labor market tighter than it would be otherwise. And so I think that's kind of the challenge here, is if the Fed really keeps to its mandate of tight, not strong labor markets, then there's nothing to do, nothing to worry about on the employment side. And on the flip side, you know, the inflation numbers, they, you know, I don't know, we should have like a little tracker here of how many months, what's this, 51 months of above the Fed's mandate when it comes to core PCE. And that is moving in the wrong direction based upon today's data and the likely data ahead. And so maybe tariffs are transitory, maybe they're not. It's a little bit of a dirty word. But certainly if you take the data at face value, it looks like it's not moving in the right direction for the Fed. And so you put those two things together, you know, they're basically constrained unless you see a much more meaningful deterioration in the labor market. You know, we're going to see, I think, a frozen Fed, even as growth rates soften considerably in the economy.
Thank you, Bob. And I think you gave some of us some market flashbacks with using the word of transitory. But hopefully nobody gets too hung up like I am a little bit here. Now, just kind of continuing that vein of, you know, like leading indicators per se, the Conference Board's leading economic index fell again in June, now down, I think, 2.8% in the first half of 2025 as a whole. And this marks three straight quarters of that decline. And so I wonder, and I'm going to pick on Jem for this one, is the Fed underestimating recession risk at this point, or are we kind of just toeing the line toward their two-part mandate as usual?
Yeah, I think the reality is, kind of as Bob insinuated, that both sides are not going really in the right direction, right? And this is the stagflationary thing we've been talking about on here for really a year plus, maybe 2 years. You know, tariffs are structurally stagflationary. Like, there's little debate about that. You know, we might debate that, you know, in the fake news kind of columns and places, but the reality is, you know, you can't create deglobalization and not slow down both growth and increase inflation. And that's what we're seeing in the numbers forward looking, you know, particularly in college graduate employment, particularly for men, dramatically increasing. I'll come back to that a little bit later. I think that's a major problem. You know, that's an early indicator in general. You know, not hiring college grads is generally a leading indicator to increasing unemployment. So yes, I do think we are sleeping on a slowdown. We're also seeing margin compression across much of, you know, again, we've been, there's a lag to all this because, you know, there's a lag to tariff policy. But we are seeing those numbers starting to filter through as we move forward. And again, that's true for on both sides. And so the Fed is in a box. They are quite simply dealing with sticky inflation still, you know, transitorily, like for, you know, the fourth, fifth year in a row here. And they're also now dealing with what looks like increasing unemployment and, you know, profit margins coming down as well. So yes, they're in a box. I guess I would add one more important element to that that probably puts them on hold, which is the Treasury is stimulating. You know, issuing more debt on the front end of the curve is quiet QE. Continuing to do that, different stimulus is also coming from the markets and the push up in assets throughout this period. So we're getting liquidity coming into the market. There's no lack of liquidity. The loosening of, you know, SLR requirements, et cetera. Banks have plenty of room to continue to provide liquidity here too. So all of that together is creating a situation where the Fed is better off not overstimulating and waiting and seeing kind of how this plays out. And that's true on both sides.
Thank you, Jem. Adam, do you have anything to add there on either the topic of that leading economic index falling three quarters in a row or on the workforce that we are seeing?
You know, Nicholas, you might be a little disappointed today. I feel like we're just going to have a lot of agreement among the hosts so far. It sounds like...
Are you going to take my drama away from me, Adam?
I'm sure we'll find something. But I agree that the proximate impact of the tariffs is going to be increase inflation, slow growth a bit. I guess I would say when we're talking about current conditions, I think the bigger factor right now is simply that the Fed remains above neutral. They're in a tough spot. Undoubtedly, they're in a tough spot because they did not get to see inflation come all the way down to where they want it to be. But monetary policy works with a lag, a substantial lag. So the Fed should not wait until inflation is back to normal in order to then push rates back to normal. That would be behind the curve. And I think that they are at the behind the curve stage right now. And I think the slowing of the economy is proof of that. A few folks have mentioned like the tick up in unemployment for recent college graduates. I think we can see it in the slower. Obviously, Q2 GDP came in strong, but that's extremely noisy. If you look through the noise in the first half of the year, and you look at something like private final purchases, like it's definitely slowed. And I think what we're seeing is there's two macro stories. One is the tariffs and their impact, and the other is rates remaining above neutral and their impact. And frankly, I think the Fed is making their job so much harder by waiting to adjust interest rates until these two stories become more entangled. I think that they are waiting for to quote unquote see what happens. What do you mean see what happens? We know what's going to happen. Inflation is going to tick up. And then what are you going to say? Like, oh, it ticked up, so now we can cut? Like, I find myself very frustrated with the Fed stance. They should have cut before the storm arrived. They should have cut before the noise arrived, not wait till it's stormy and noisy and they're going to struggle to see through. They're going to have a harder time making the case for rate cuts once inflation picks up from tariffs. But tariffs are, they should be one time, especially tariffs of the magnitude we're looking at. If you were talking about 100% tariffs, 150% tariffs, even 75%, the sort of Liberation Day tariffs that we had, you have to worry about massive, massive crushing impacts on the supply side. Tons of firm failures, businesses going out of business, global, trade halting to zero. In that environment, you have to worry about unexpected kind of huge inflationary impacts. We're talking more about 15% tariffs. Those are bad. We should not do them. They are not good. But this is not the kind of tariff that's going to cause a massive crunch on the supply side and lead to a surprising permanent inflationary shock. So I don't know. I think we're behind the curve.
Last bear, would you agree with that sentiment?
I do think that there's a lot of signals from different parts of the economy that shows slowing or show concerning signs. One of the things that I think is notable is if you think about from the White House, their perspective on the need to rapidly lower rates immediately and the fact that Powell's behind the curve. I think a lot of that is coming from sort of a home building and construction perspective. Obviously, Trump's background in real estate, but also Pulte, who's the is sort of leading the charge on the housing front from the White House perspective. They're looking at a housing market that has slowed really substantially, particularly over the last year, with inventory counts now sort of back to the pre-COVID level on an aggregate basis across the country. But if you look at areas of high home building activities, like in the South, Sun Belt, the situation does really look a lot worse. I think you also see things like in the trucking market. Obviously, some amount of that's impacted by tariffs, imports and exports impacting volumes, but a lot of that also is driven by housing activity as well. And you see carriers starting to go under. You see volumes that are actually now below 2019 levels on an aggregate basis across the trucking market. Just signs that overall activity is slowing, even if sort of headline numbers on employment haven't shown a rapid deterioration. Sort of a more gradual softening, but I think if you look at construction spending overall per the government's official statistics on that, that's now in a negative year-over-year position in nominal terms, let alone real terms. So you do see these sort of bigger aspects of the economy that maybe don't get the same attention all the time as technology and AI, but these sort of big sectors that have a lot of dollars behind them slowing down. So there definitely is a case, but at the same time, from the Fed's perspective, and Bob mentioned it, we've mentioned it every month here for a long time, that the Fed still has for years and years now not achieved their mandate. And you don't have employment falling off a cliff, even if it continues to be sort of, gradually softening for several years. You don't see the acceleration to the downside that would really say, hey, all of a sudden we need to really act and act firmly now. So I think that they are, gonna let it, gonna let it continue to play out. Obviously, that's the market's expectation, is that there aren't going to be changes to the policy rate in the immediate future. but I do think that they're also in a position where they feel that they have a loaded gun too, or, you know, bullets in the chamber in terms of the ability to stimulate pretty aggressively via rate cuts when that time comes. So, you know, we're not in a ZERT situation where the Fed doesn't have a lot of leeway. I think if, you know, if they wanted to, they could decrease by 200, 300 basis points if things really go downhill quickly. And so I think that also probably gives them some confidence to continue to maintain a strong perspective here, or at least sort of, you know, hold out until there's more data.
Thank you, Last Bear. Something you said there also reminded me of something that Jeffrey Gundlach from Double Line Capital recently said. He was arguing that, like, to your comment on the mandate, he's argued that the soft landing narrative itself is an illusion, and that deteriorating credit conditions signal a hard landing ahead. And so I wonder, Marco, if you don't mind giving your input here, how do you feel about that sentiment that the soft landing narrative is an illusion, it's impossible to avoid a hard land?
I think that's actually spot on. This is something that I've had. This view I've had for like 2 years. I think that soft landing is actually just a temporary environment in which the economy is actually transitioning from growth into a slowdown or a recession. So we can actually treat this scenario as temporary. Like, it can last for a year or two or three or something, but eventually we'll probably get to a point where the economy is actually going to enter the recession. This has probably not happened yet, although I a few times before I thought that maybe the economy was on the verge of entering the recession. When we see the unemployment rate, it hasn't actually moved much over the past 12 months. This is like it's mostly gone sideways. Like there was this spike in July last year, and the market got worried about it. But initially, the unemployment rate was reported at 4.3, but was later revised down to 4.2, and actually May now stands as the highest rate in like four years. This is like 4.24. Like we haven't gone to 4.3 yet, and I don't know if the unemployment rate doesn't go up, the Fed will probably be reluctant to cut rates. Like this is a type of environment where some have been describing it as no or low low hiring, low firing environment. And if this continues for several more months, we can easily end up with no cuts in 2025. That doesn't mean that we won't get cuts later on, but maybe we won't get cuts in 2025. That said, I still agree with most of the thoughts here, especially the one that says the economy is weaker than the Fed is currently saying. Definitely, like here is the recession risk is far higher than of course they are saying, and then the consensus view as well. So this will be interesting to see when will be this tipping point between this sort of limbo where we see no hiring, no firing environment in the labor market, and transition into a more meaningful slowdown where the economy the unemployment rate is going to pick up faster. So this will be this will be something to watch. And I think that the Fed is actually going to wait until they actually see that. And when they see that, they are probably going to be late.
Thank you, Marco.
This is my way. Yeah.
Thank you very much. And you actually led me into something else on the labor market I wanted to touch on before we move along. Former Fed Governor Lael Brainard recently warned of what he referred to as a delayed labor unwind and pointed to temporary hiring freezes across sectors. Like Marco was saying, not a lot of hiring, not a lot of firing in the current climate. And so I wonder, how can or how is the Fed kind of preparing for the potential sudden out of nowhere jump in jobless claims? Jim?
Yeah, so I think the reality is that the way markets tend to work is there's a reflexivity. If assets are and liquidity are strong, that some people call it the wealth effect. I think, that illustrates that it's about people's wealth. I think it has less to do with that than liquidity at institutional level. But regardless, that wealth effect can really support what might be otherwise and mask what might be otherwise weakness under the surface. And the reason these things sometimes turn very quickly is that markets themselves can move very quickly. And so if you begin to get a removal of that wealth effect in the face of structural economic weakness underneath it, then things can accelerate very quickly. So I just want to kind of highlight that kind of that picture and why things can turn all of a sudden. The things that seem steady, due to multiple contradictory forces, can then, when one of those forces, which is high frequency, moves the market in particular, all of a sudden accelerate the broader trend. So if, I'm right, and that's kind of how this is playing out at this point, and early indicators on the structural side of the economy are weakening due to a lag in tariffs and policy, which kind of front-loaded kind of a pull forward in demand in preparation for the tariffs. And now you're starting to see it kind of that lag work through. To other people's point on here, that could show, and it's starting to show with leading indicators, a deterioration there that could potentially, if the market doesn't keep ripping higher, decline faster than people expect. If that's the case, what is the Fed likely to do? Well, I think at some point they will have to accelerate liquidity into those parts of the market. Unfortunately, the tools they have to support the market and to support employment, will be not necessarily right. That won't be able to respond in the way that the things are declining, right? You have a structurally stagflationary environment, and if all of a sudden they start stimulating, you take interest rates down enough, there's enough pent-up demand in the real estate market, for example, that you could drive significant appreciation in certain parts of the market, which could be, inflationary. I mean, we've been seeing actually a decline despite the inflationary numbers looking slightly worse here going on a look forward basis. It's remained less hot because of owner, the rents piece, right? The living expenses part that was quite hot earlier, really not showing the inflation lately. So those parts actually, as you cut rates, can drive actual structural inflation again. And we saw something very similar in the 60s and 70s, which I pointed to, when Arthur Burns came in. So I would argue that, if we get to a situation where this does slow down and the Fed eventually does respond, particularly under kind of pressure from the administration, under potentially a new chairman in June of next year, I would argue that even you could get a even worse stagflationary picture where, yes, you're responding to a acceleration and a decline in growth, but that inflation then at the same time starts to pick up. So that'd be what I would highlight. But other than that, I think, pretty well documented what the Fed will do, if those numbers start to fall off a cliff.
Thank you, Jim. And to that note there on inflation expectations, if I'm not mistaken, Mohamed El-Erian recently noted that those expectations had reached to the highest in over three decades, at 4.1%. And he's also noted that the inflation pressures themselves seem to be more driven by tariffs and energy rather than demand. And so I guess my question to that, and I'll pick on Joseph for this one, is how does the Fed, or I guess rather, how should the Fed be affected in their decision-making processes despite that?
So the way that the Fed looks at inflation expectations is it's really important to them that they be anchored. From their perspective, they think that if inflation expectations are anchored, then realized inflation will probably be anchored as well. Now, I don't know if that's how the world actually works, but from their perspective, inflation expectations actually are anchored. If you look at, say, five-year inflation swaps, they're basically range-bound. If you look at the surveys the Fed gives, there's a whole bunch of them. You know, we all know the U-Mish one is kind of ridiculous, but it's been coming back. The ones, say, the New York Fed does shows in the longer term, it is, you know, reasonably anchored. So people did have this scare for, let's say, one-year inflation expectations during the tariff regime, but longer term, the survey suggests that they're anchored. So I don't think the Fed is worried about inflation expectations being anchored. All the commentary that they give say that they think it's anchored. And to be clear, sometimes they think that what they say actually impacts what people, how people form the inflation expectations. So some of it is some propaganda effect. So one other thing that I'll note that we haven't mentioned is that we talked a lot about, you know, labor market, inflation, so forth, the Fed's two mandates. But one other dimension that's really important is just how restrictive is the Fed. Now, there are some interesting differences on the FOMC about this. Chair Powell last time described policy as modestly restrictive, right? So maybe one of the reasons why he doesn't want to cut is he doesn't actually think policy is that restrictive. You can point to things to show that, to support that. You can say narrow credit spreads, or you can say, pretty elevated equity markets. But of course, you could also point to other segments of the economy, like the housing market, where rates are obviously restrictive. Now, going on to the rate cut today camp, Governor Waller would point to say that the FOMC's dot plot suggests that neutral is around 3%. We're 150 basis points above that. We're obviously, you know, reasonably restrictive, right? So we can easily calibrate our policy spans to be a little bit less restrictive simply because we're so much above neutral. So there is this difference in perception of how tight monetary policy is on the FOMC, and that's also playing a part in driving this different policy recommendations we're going to hear about soon.
So back on that topic here of energy and food being those primary drivers of price pressure, especially heading into quarter four toward the end of the year here, does that alone really justify holding rates steady, even if, you know, the core services inflation continues to fade? I guess my question to this is what is or what should be the deciding factor here? Adam, do you mind?
I wouldn't let expectations of food and energy inflation push me off of the belief that rates should come down. I think you need a couple of data points. One is, what's the neutral rate? The FOMC, according to projections, thinks it's around 3%. And then, are we above that? Yes, we're substantially above that. And how far are we from hitting the Fed's target in a sustainable way? Sort of absent tariff shocks, I think we would be hitting that this summer. And so there's no basis for having rates so far above neutral, for a point above neutral, point and a half, when you've got you would otherwise be on the trajectory to where you need to be. I think it'd be better to get as close to neutral. It's going to take, you know, you shouldn't wait until you're there to take your foot off the gas, off the brakes. So yeah, I wouldn't worry about the food and energy expectations. I don't think we have that high of a risk of a sort of stagflationary problems absent some other policy changes. It's always on the table, in the sense that, you know, Senator Hawley suggested we should take the tariff revenues and refund them. That's a recipe for stagflation right there, because you'd have a really, really substantial expansion of fiscal spending, and so demand shock at the same time that you're dealing with a supply shock. Now that sounds like 2021 to me. That's the kind of situation we would be in if you were passing through doing the massive deficit spending from the tariffs and passing that through, and not of the same magnitude. Obviously, you're not going to be doing $1.9 trillion kind of overnight like ARP was, but you'd be doing some of it, potentially dealing with supply shock too. So I agree with the panelists in general. I think we're going to see slightly higher inflation, slightly higher unemployment rates. I think the Fed should look through those things. But other macro things could throw us way off. In addition to if there was more fiscal spending, I think trying to get rid of Powell is another thing that could spiral us off into crisis. I think a return of Liberation Day level tariffs could push us into crisis. And I just think those things are all still on the table. So I'm not suggesting everyone relax. I'm just suggesting based on the Fed has to work with what they know. And based on what they know, I think we have enough information for them to sort of relax and get to cutting.
Well, I know Adam was worried that we would all agree with each other. So I'll come in with a moment of disagreement with both what Joseph was saying and Adam around neutral rates, which is modeled neutral rates are not very helpful in understanding the effects of current policy on the economy. And the reason why that is because it's very complicated to understand all of the first, second, and third order effects of shifts in interest rates on the rest of the economy. And so from my perspective, when I think about neutral, I think about it from the context of it's an empirical question, not a model question. And if you're sitting in the Fed shoes and you look at what's going on, current interest rates have basically been in place for a year, give or take, in the ballpark of where we've been for a year. The unemployment rate has been flat and inflation has basically been stable at a level above their mandate and is now ticking up. You add that all up together, and I'd say that looks like a neutral rate to me. Now, that doesn't mean that certain sectors aren't doing well or doing badly, like, you know, certain housing-related sectors. It also doesn't mean that certain sectors aren't doing remarkably well, like the entire crypto industry. It just means when you look at it in aggregate, we are at a point of generally a point of balance when you're thinking about the two core attributes that the Fed is focused on, which is the tightness of the labor market and the inflation measure. And so therefore, I don't think that there's any, the current interest rate's at neutral. And I think the empirics support that. That'll surely mix it up.
Yeah, and I'm actually going to agree a bit with Bob, but add some nuance. One, real rates, when we talk about real rates, you can't look backwards at past inflation, right? When you're looking at forward interest rates, you got to think forward, you know, what are inflation expectations? What's likely to happen to inflation? I think that's a big part of it. And I think the reality is there are a lot, like the tariff policy is clearly working its way through. We're starting to see the effects. Powell has been very clear that the next several months of data are going to be very informative, and they are, and they're going in the direction that he has been concerned about. So that's the reason why real rates are as positive as they are, because one, you're looking at post-inflation, and one, you're looking at kind of forward. And I think that's critical. Two, I want to highlight, it's not just about real rates. That's an easy kind of one-dimensional kind of model to play with. Like, what are real rates, positive or negative? The Fed has other kind of soft mandates. And one is just how loose is his policy? How much liquidity is actually being pushed out there? What's happening in markets as a function of that policy? And it's important to note there's a soft QE essentially happening under the hood via the Treasury. I think it's fair to say if real rates were super positive, but all of a sudden Treasury moved all of its issuance to the first 9 months of the curve, which would be crazy, but you know, there were threats of that. I don't think it's likely, but the point here is that is QE. I mean, if you move all the issuance to day one, that is the biggest QE probably we've ever seen, right? Definitely. And so, you know, the Fed is somewhat hemmed in terms of its ability to stimulate by what's happening from the administration. And so I think between those two, you know, both the forward inflation expectations and the realities of what we're starting to see and how quickly those numbers are changing due to the policy disruption, and also as a result of the actual soft, you know, quiet QE, I'd call it, that's happening underneath the hood, and you can see in the liquidity numbers, really puts the Fed in a box. And it's not all about real rates, I guess, is the big point.
So I Adam, I see your hand, but I want to ask a follow-up here, specifically on the topic of that quiet easing. And Adam, you can start, but I want to kick this follow-up here around the whole panel. To that note, if real yields remain historically high, despite no change in the nominal rate, couldn't that be considered more of a form of passive tightening by the Fed?
Yeah, so it's a great question. I think it's important to look to inflation expectations and when you're calculating real rates to understand what's happening. So I'm not sure about the nominal the tightening. But I do think that the understanding where the neutral rate is really important. I agree with Bob. We can't put a whole lot of faith on modeled estimates. What I would point to is I think we were really seeing the revelation from the evolution of the economy from 2018 through 2019. What the economy really spoke about what were neutral rates, because the Fed was trying to raise rates. And the economy began slowing down. Trump, to his credit, had this absolutely right, identifying at the time, look, you're getting ahead of where the economy is. You need to lower rates. And they did. They cut rates, even though there was no macro shock. It was simply a realization that they were getting them too far above neutral and that there remains slack in the labor market. So I think I don't think there is a lot of reason to think that the neutral rate is so drastically different than what it was back then. And the FOMC thinks it's 3%. So there's an interesting question here, which is, what should the FOMC do unconditionally, right? Which then, of course, you have to determine what you think the neutral rate is. But conditionally on believing the neutral rate is 3%, what should the FOMC do? And I think even those who disagree with their assessment should agree that they shouldn't be this far above what they think the neutral rate is. And I think there's a strong case for a 3% neutral rate, because I think, you know, before 2019, it was, you know, 2.5, 1.5. Like, there's no reason to think that neutral is so much stronger. We're not in that much stronger of a growth of a real growth environment. Especially, and again, I think this is something that goes understated. Everyone on the panel seems to agree that tariffs are going to lower real GDP growth going forward. Okay, that's a lower real neutral rate. And I think however you want to, you know, calculate it out, your expectations of the neutral rate relative to 2019 should be more pessimistic. So maybe you thought, oh, we're out of the pandemic, we've got this great new economy, we're heading to a happy new future with stronger productivity growth and stronger real GDP growth. It seems like you should be revising down those expectations, and you should be thinking, well, actually, the neutral rate probably is closer to 2019. Things probably aren't on net that much stronger going forward. I think that's where we should be. So I agree with Bob. Don't put too much stake in that modeling, but that's my read of the market. That's my read of the economy, the evolution of the economy, and sort of the economic history there. And I think that was the evolving consensus at the time, and we shouldn't forget about that.
Beautifully said, Adam. Thank you. Joseph, there has been a lot of discourse back and forth about rates, about policy, up until this point, and I would love to hear if you have anything to add to that before I switch course toward a different direction.
Well, I'd echo Jim's point about how going forward, when you're thinking about rates, it's not just about what the Fed does, because going forward, it looks like it's going Treasury is going to play also a greater role in managing the maturity profile of the debt. So, you know, looking forward, let's say longer dated rates, in part due to the expected path of policy, but also in part due to supply and demand dynamics. Now, we saw in a couple years ago, Secretary Yellen seemed to lower the maturity profile of Treasury's outstanding by having a larger share of bill issuance, and that seemed to put some downward pressure on longer dated yields. And as Jim noted, the president has, you know, kind of made these big claims that shouldn't issue anything that matures beyond 9 months. Of course, we're not going to do that. But usually how the president operates is that he makes these big statements and then negotiates it down, right? So at the moment, again, we had TVAC today. Coupon issuance is not changing. They guided towards not changing it for several quarters. But in the future, though, you could easily see a scenario where, you know, let's say the Treasury really does want to significantly shorten its WAM, let's say ramp up bill issuance from say 21% to 25% of total debt outstanding. That will have a big impact on longer dated interest rates. So I think we should keep in mind that there are many dimensions to this game. And right now, in the past, the executive has not been willing to play with that and kind of in part left the maturity composition to say the Fed can do QE, which effectively shortens the consolidated balance sheet debt of the government. But now if they're more willing to use it, we have to look at what the Fed is going to do, what they think, like the discussion here, what they perceive to be the neutral rate, which is always going to be very difficult to know, but also how Treasury wants to manage their debt issuance. So it's going to be an even more complicated puzzle.
So I'm going to jump us in, and I'm hesitant to do so. Jim, I know you have to leave in about 15 minutes or so, and I know we've got data coming in about 15 minutes or so, so I'm a little hesitant to jump into such a loaded topic. But boys, let's talk tariffs. Trump's new tariff proposals include copper duties and 10% universal import tax beginning in August. I think August 1st, with no chance of a delay, based on what was said recently. As we all know, what was said is always subject to change. Now, if implemented, some are pretty concerned about supply-driven inflation that may persist for several quarters or even longer. Now, as a bit of a two-parter before we get into the weeds, first, is this a viable concern? And second, how should the Fed be reacting to this possibility, if so? Let's start with Last Bear on this.
So I think one thing just to keep in mind, you're talking about the latest tariff announcements, which continue to sort of roll out and change on a daily basis. But I do think that something to keep in mind on tariffs is just the lagging effect that it has. I think the nice thing is you can actually see the cash that's coming into the Treasury on at least sort of a monthly basis from the Customs Department. And so we can track really easily and specifically how much money is you know being paid in tariff revenue, and we see that's increased substantially in each month since April when big tariffs were initially announced. And so that's likely to continue to increase going forward as you have things like the EU tariffs going from 10% to 15%, and similar on Japan. Obviously China has come down from that peak level, but I don't know how much was actually getting paid at that 130%, you know, rate that we had for a couple of weeks there. So I think you to see the actual cash increasing month over month over month over the past, you know, 4 months, let's call it, and that's likely to continue. And then secondarily, you have the concept that retailers have, you know, months of supply of inventory, and they're also waiting out this uncertainty in terms of, you know, tariff levels and how to adjust prices and how to adjust their own sort of business plan around it. And so I think that there is just that we shouldn't necessarily look back at the first 6 weeks or first 2 months after sort of Liberation Day announcements, especially given that obviously a lot of that was dialed back for a period of time, and say, hey, tariffs aren't have any sort of impact on it. I think that if you think about it on an aggregate level, we're already annualizing at something like $350 billion worth of tariff revenue, which is significant. It's significant in the context of the deficit overall. If we talk about deficit spending being a key driver of the economy over the past 4 years, 350 million or whatever it turns out to be with these higher tariffs, let's call it 400 billion. That's a meaningful portion of the overall deficit. It's about a quarter of it. And so when we're talking about the fiscal impulse, I think that is, it is a meaningful change. And when you think about how companies might respond to it, obviously, yes, companies might increase prices. They also might decrease costs by laying off workers or sort of tightening the belts internally. You see that with things like, Walmart, as an example. There's been a number of announcements of job cuts at Walmart over the past couple of months. And obviously, they're a retailer that operates on 3%, net margins. And so, and they're one of the biggest importers in the country. So for a company like that, as they're starting to see, their inventory go out the door, they have to adjust prices. They've been very clear about the fact that that price hikes are coming in the coming months. And I think that's probably indicative of, the broader retail landscape. And how do you adjust for that? Some amount you can probably take in price, you're probably going to lose some amount in volume, and you're probably going to have to do things up internally. And so I do think that despite the fact that, that things have held up relatively stably so far, I think it's worth taking a little bit of a longer term perspective, particularly given the recent announcements that we've seen about just, increasing levels on huge trading partners like the EU and Japan. Things like auto sales, stuff like that is companies are really just starting to be able to, make these big decisions, partially because they don't know if things are going to go back or, hoping that things just sort of revert. But as it kind of continues going on and more and more money is going out the door in terms of custom duties, you're going to see sort of the rubber meets the road in terms of business decisions. And ultimately, it's a reversal to some extent of the fiscal impulse that has really been quite powerful in the economy for the past several years.
Yeah, just because I have limited time, too, I thought I'd dive in on this a little bit. I think, look, if you're in a generally stagflationary environment, demand has been pulled forward and now is slowing, right? Because, you tell companies and people that tariffs are coming, but we're going to put a 90-day lag on. What do you think companies do, right? They pull forward demand. They put more stuff in inventories. They do all the things, and then the tariffs start rolling out. Then there's a give back, right? So that's not a surprise. But then when the tariffs run through, and this is the kind of the mental model, is, what's the first thing? I mean, it's a direct, this is a direct cut to profits for companies that are importing anything from abroad, and so profit margins then start to be the first sign of the issues, right? The companies start having to eat that they would pass it on. But the problem with passing it on is the economy is starting to look weak. And so they don't feel comfortable passing it on because you're in a stagflationary environment. So profit margins are kind of the first place to look. And sure enough, we're in the middle of earnings season. And sure enough, if you look closely, you're starting to see it. And it's not just Walmart, which announced that last month ahead of the time and got a tongue lashing from the administration. But there are others quietly now putting it out there in all the earnings calls. So look at that closely. It's happening. What's generally the next stop? Well, if profit margins decline and there's a companies stop hiring, right? I mean, and that's there's a bit of a lag to that. And guess what? We're starting to see that as well. Probably not a coincidence, right? That's why that leads. And then the lack of hiring eventually, if you get a slowdown, leads to firing, which then leads to political kind of, we need to do something about this. People aren't happy, as well as Federal Reserve. Things are slowing. Markets may decline. They may not. But if they do, then that can accelerate like we highlighted before. That's kind of the the mental model. Now, how does that play out after that? Well, fiscal policy, guess what? We got midterms next year again, you know, starts to come back, spending to support the political, you know, the unhappiness from the slowdown. And there we go. And then comes inflation on the back of the stimulus and all the others. So that, you know, people are focused on kind of all the different parts. And is it a slowdown? Is it inflationary? Like, the answer is, we are seeing all the clues that this is working its way through, and that's generally the path that this will likely take.
So I am going to go ahead and pick on Last Bear here, kind of a little bit about financial conditions, because right now they're more or less as loose as they were even in early 2021, despite arguably restrictive policy rates. And so I wonder on this point here, and I know, Last Bear, I kind of pick on you about credit, et cetera, pretty frequently, but is the Fed unintentionally fueling risk asset speculation and credit expansion out this process currently?
Well, I think it's definitely hard to make a case that financial conditions are tight. I would agree that they're fairly loose, and we've seen a bounce back from sort of the extreme and market sentiment from sort of post-Liberation Day panic to, you know, back to sort of what we saw towards the end of last year and early part of this year, which is, you know, really aggressive, arguably quite speculative moves. And a lot of, you know, if you're thinking about, there obviously are parts of the market, especially, you know, technology that really has held up a lot better than I think some people might have expected around AI CapEx spend and all that kind of stuff. But then there's other parts of the market that are, you know, truly, you know, pre-revenue speculative stuff that continues to go up 10% a day. And I think that is indicative of, you know, a level of speculation in the market overall. If you look at sort of the options volume, sort of calls versus puts, or sort of net, you know, call volume versus net put volume, you're looking at sort of the same levels that we saw back with the GameStop squeeze back in 2021 or other periods of sort of this extreme euphoria. So is how much of that is the Fed versus how much of that is sort of just, you know, the market kind of swinging through its pendulum? It's really tough to say. I do think that, you know, the Fed could theoretically be more aggressive in terms of saying, you know, obviously, even if they're saying that they're holding rates constant for the immediate term, they've said in their dot plots that they're going to continue to cut going forward at some point in the not too distant future. And so when you have a dot plot that shows ongoing easing for the next 18 months or 2 years or so until they finally decide that they're at their neutral rate at around 3% or whatever it might be, that's sort of a fair, it's sort of game on. It's a green light for the market to anticipate whether it happens this month or whether it happens 2 months or 6 months from now. Basically, the trend is going to be in a positive easing, further easing direction until the Fed says otherwise. So one thing that really could, if the market was to all of a sudden decide, hey, maybe these rates aren't coming, maybe this inflationary is more significant than we might think. Maybe the employment market has actually kind of reached some sort of equilibrium where things are not deteriorating. And I think, you know, a lot of the data over the past couple of months has not, you know, has shown sort of a levelization in some respects. And the market says, hey, maybe the neutral rate, to Bob's point earlier, maybe we're at neutral. Maybe, you know, there does need to be more term premium in the long term. And if you see long-term yields spike, that's something that really could sort of bring the market back in the check. But I think it's tough from the Fed's perspective to sort of different. I don't think that they're looking at the market on a day-to-day basis and, you know, making their policy position based off of that. I think it's very clear that they're not, because if they were, they'd be much more aggressive right now. They probably would have been much easier at different points over the past couple of years. So maybe I hope that starts to answer the question.
No, that was beautiful, Last Bear. Thank you. Jim, I see your hand, and I know you got a split. Did you have something to add, or is Twitter trolling me again?
I think Twitter's trolling you, but I got a minute or two, so let me just add my last piece here. One thing I wanted to just mention is, you know, there's been so much talk about the Fed chair and the discord between Trump and Powell, et cetera. I want to be very clear on this topic. Again, we haven't addressed it here, but I want to be very clear. That is Trump simply trying to do the effect the long end of the curve as much as he can through that rhetoric. That is not a real threat. The market seems to at times believe it's possible, but that's him communicating like, we are going to stimulate aggressively when we get the chance. That's every time he gets up there and shows up at the Fed or threatens that he's going to do X or Y. You know, why do I feel so confidently about that? One, you know, the stress of firing Powell on markets would be unproductive, to say the least. It would cause a lot of problems on the swaps and never mind create potentially a buyer's strike from the international community, a distrust of Fed policy. The Fed chair, let's say we put Bessent in as Fed chair, it's not like all of a sudden they just control that Fed chair can just change the policy rate. I'm guessing the other 11 governors probably wouldn't be too happy if the Fed's independence is all of a sudden brought into question overnight. You're not going to get the policy result you want any quicker than June when you take over the chairmanship. Anyway, if you do that, it's probably counterproductive, not to mention the legal issues with doing it anyway. So the market keeps freaking out about this. It keeps, people keep talking about it. It's in the news. It's a narrative that's flying all over the place. That's what Trump wants. And he's accomplishing essentially getting some easing benefits, so pulling forward his policy goals in June by continuing to keep it in the media. It is not a real threat. And I just want to put that out there as my last piece. Thank you guys. And good luck today.
Appreciate it, Jim. Thanks as always, man. Really good points. Love having you here. All right, Bob, I did see your hand and I do want to continue this discourse, but we got to surprise of no one a rate hold. While we've been kind of chilling here a bit, is there anything standing out to anyone in the drop before we kind of continue that conversation?
I just know that we did get two dissents from two governors. That's very unusual. And again, they wanted to cut rates. Also, strangely, Governor Krugler was not there today. I don't know. Maybe she was busy doing something else, but that stood out to me that I don't usually see that.
And they did kind of prelude the drop that they would if there were no cut. But is it kind of seeming like September is going to be the month of glory?
Like you mentioned when we began, that's what the market is pricing. A good chance we'd have a cut in September.
I mean, I think my skeptical side of this is that we've got two people who are engaged in political rhetoric in signaling to the administration their desire to be the next person in line behind Chairman Powell. And this is a low-cost way to do that. Basically takes no effort, meaning it has no actual effect, and nonetheless, you know, puts them on the short list of who will be considered. And so I would look at that stuff, and it looks like political rhetoric much more than it does serious policymaking, let's say.
Anyone else have anything else to comment on the drop as we kind of breeze over them? You knew that last combo.
I'm going to push back against that a little bit. So, yes, Governor Wallet definitely wants the Fed chair. It's not a secret. But I think you can make a very principled and reasonable case for a rate cut today. And I think many people on the panel have been making that, right? So you are far above neutral. You have inflation, let's say, probably one-time price shock. And also you have the labor market cracking. And we all know the economy is slowing, right? We're doing obvious things that will slow down the economy, lower immigration, raising taxes in the form of tariffs. So I think it's a case that you can reasonably make, and many people make it. So I wouldn't just completely dismiss this as just political posturing.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think that you can't know what's in Waller's heart, but he has made a case which is, you don't have to agree with it, but it's a strong case. It's fully thought through. It's completely rationalized. It's not inconsistent with his past views. There are obviously other contenders who are sort of more just like, you know, Judy Shelton is a lifelong gold bug. She's a lifelong hawk, and now she's making the case for rate cuts. It's not that's someone who is trying to get hired. And again, we can't know whether what Waller motivations are, but there's nothing in his argument that stands out as inconsistent with anything we knew about him in the past, or that stands out as shockingly heterodox or anything like that.
I was just going to add the other change in language in the statement versus the prior from a little bit over a month ago is more negative on the economy overall, noting that I think it went from saying expanded at a solid pace to growth has moderated in the first half of the year. And I think they took out some language on diminished out a diminished uncertainty to now just being normal uncertainty. So I guess that's two negatives, but a little bit more negative on the economy, but maybe that was a little bit, I think it was probably more consistent with the language that they put out maybe in the April, May timeframe, but a little bit of a downgrade versus June.
I think that piece is interesting because it basically sets up a conversation, which hopefully the folks asking questions in the room will really draw on, which is what is the actual focus? Because, at the same time, the statement, there's a comment that or whatever, at the same time it gets revised down that says economic activity moderated, which, it seems as though the Fed does know how to read the GDP report accurately, which is a good thing. At the same time, it says labor market conditions remain solid and inflation somewhat elevated. And so, I think there is some ambiguity here in terms of the nuance or in terms of the prioritization of those different points and whether the slowing of the growth is going to be the issue, the primary focus or the strength of the labor market. Right now, if you look at the short rate market is pretty all in that the Fed is going to, weigh more heavily the slowing of growth relative to the tightness of the labor market. But it'll be important to see, to get a feel of that from Powell today.
That kind of brings up something that I didn't touch on when the main focus of the conversation was labor. But I will now, to your point there, Bob, with headline employment still strong, nuance is definitely important because there are sectors like transportation, tech, retail, especially, all softening, some more than others, for example, retail. Should the Fed be more focused on granular labor weaknesses as keeping a lookout for a domino effect type situation?
Well, I think the challenge that the challenge somewhat hopefully the Fed has learned in the last couple of years is that they're no good at reading the tea leaves. And as a result, their best bet instead of trying to figure out whether transportation is a leading sector or transportation employment is leading or orthogonal to the economy or the same thing with healthcare or this or that is that, it's better to be looking more holistically at what's going on rather than narrowly at what's going on or focusing on particular bits and pieces. And so my guess is that the conversation is going to be more holistic in nature than particularly focused on certain areas, and probably more, the place where they're going to do some leading work is going to be more, I think, around the tariffs and how they're interpreting what's going on with the tariffs and how they're expected to flow through, which it's not like particularly well telegraphed in this piece. They could have been a little more forceful in terms of the risks to the upside of inflation rather than sort of diagnostic the way the statement is read. And again, that'll be an important, where is Powell leaning? Is he leaning towards the backward looking inflation numbers? Or is he leaning towards the prospect of tariff related inflation flowing through? And is he leaning towards that being transitory? Those are sort of the different pieces that will be important to draw out in the course of the conversation. It starts at 2:30.
Bob, so I kind of want to pivot just a tiny bit, kind of playing off the topic of labor and going into a little bit more about housing and consumer stress. For example, there's been some pretty good evidence of consumer credit delinquencies rising, and I think it was auto loans are at all-time highs, while we're seeing other credit delinquencies in general being at all-time highs. If we see this trend continue alongside the threat of home equity beginning to erode, would that trigger a reversal in consumer confidence, even if the job losses narrative remains modest? Let's go Marco and kick this one around.
Well, I think that these things are probably going to go hand in hand. Because the labor market starts weakening, this is the point where consumers are going to freak out, start freaking out. The housing market currently is not declining. Like people have been saying that it's weak, that it's falling off a cliff, and so on. Actually, it's more about the growth that has been slowing. And this is probably the lagged effect of the rate hikes back in 2022 and 2023. This means that whatever, if that's true, of course, this means that whatever the Fed does today or tomorrow or in the next 3 months, it wouldn't matter much, because the housing is probably going to continue to the growth in the housing market is probably going to continue to decelerate, and over time this could become a problem. But currently, it's not. Like if you look at the S&P Case-Shiller index, it's still positive. So we still don't have a year-over-year losses there, but at some point later in the year, or perhaps I don't know, early next year, things could change and we could start seeing negative year-over-year figures there. So this is something that has been rolling for quite a while, and now it's actually coming. And there's not much that the Fed can do about it, because even if they cut, it will take a lot of time before all these cuts actually take effect. So this is actually going no matter what the Fed does. But there is the other thing that people have mentioned here, and I've heard the opposing views about inflation. I've been in the camp that that tariffs are actually one-time price adjustment, and I still think so. And in that environment, we're probably not going to have a sustained inflation, unless the Fed does something like, I don't know, if they start stimulating the economy all of a sudden, like they stop doing QT, they just start doing QE or something like that, then things could turn. But at this point, it doesn't appear that this will be the case. We'll see, of course, because we don't know how the Fed is going to behave in the next months, especially if, I don't know, shadow Fed chair is picked, and then you will have Powell say one thing, and you will have the other person say another thing, and maybe there will be officials. But overall, I don't think that they are actually going to do much about it before it's too late, and probably when when they start doing things, they're probably going to overdo it. And this is where potentially inflationary risk can come into the picture, but this is probably something further out, and it's not something that I would expect over the next, I don't know, 6 months or anything like that. Probably further in the future.
Thank you, Marco. So just a little bit more kind of on the housing metrics in general. Existing home sales have kind of been falling month over month, and they fell, I think, about 3%. 2.7 was the number that I last saw in June, but inventories rose sharply. On top of that, the median home price in the U.S. hit a new high of $435,300. And so I wonder here, does this suggest that prices are kind of peaking, or is it more of an indication that demand destruction is finally settling in? Like, mortgage rates still above 7, continue to choke first-time buyers. I guess what point does the housing market weakness feed into a broader consumer pullback? We can go last bear on that one, if you don't mind. I know I pick on you about credit and housing all the time, last bear.
Yeah, no, I think of what I would say, you know, I said it earlier, but I think that you have just totally different dynamics depending on where you are in the country. And certain areas like the Northeast continues to be incredibly inventory constrained. And you see prices still just continuing to rise. But a lot of that, you know, that you didn't see the massive price appreciation in those markets in 2021, 2022 that you did throughout the South. And so in certain areas, it looks like there's probably, you know, peak prices, you know, declines in prices overall in certain markets. And then in other markets, you continue to see sort of appreciation. But I do think that it is important to mention that, you know, a lot of the areas that probably are under the most pressure from a house perspective are also the areas that have the most activity in terms of building and growth, and are probably more impactful on a broader economy level than, you know, the Northeast market, let's say, which, you know, sort of catching up to where a lot of housing, you know, where the housing prices went elsewhere in the country. And there's just not as much building activity happening in those markets as it is. So I do think it really depends on where you look. I don't think that, you know, one thing I would say is that you're not seeing, I think if you're waiting to see a 2008 type recession in terms of housing prices, I don't think that that's coming. Even in markets that are considered sort of the boom bust markets, let's say Las Vegas and Arizona, Miami, Western Florida, you know, you might have maybe a 5% decline in prices, but I don't think that you're going to see sort of the 30-40% type boom bust, just because you don't have the same dynamics around adjustable rate mortgages. A lot of the sort of increase in housing prices arguably was a result of sort of broader asset inflation and monetary debasement as it is, you know, basically a little bit more less of a specific industry boom bust and more sort of a broader appreciation across assets. So I think you're going to see maybe some deals in certain markets, but I wouldn't hold my breath for a widespread collapse in prices.
Adam, you had something to add there as well, I think.
Yeah, I think those are really great points from last bear. I would look at two important metrics to sort of get at supply and demand. On the demand side, mortgage purchase applications remain high, which means people are like thinking about getting into a house. They're doing the legwork to get into a house. So I think demand is still relatively strong. I think on the supply side, you've had a lot come on the market, obviously. We've done a lot of building over the last 2 years, and inventory has risen. And so you have to worry how are interest rates going to hold back supply and demand here. I think it's clear there's stress for the builders, but you have not seen construction employment move down yet. However much, however big the problems are they're facing, the pessimism they may have, the unsustainability of rates at this level, they are still hiring. And I think that's pretty interesting dynamic, that it should make us a little bit optimistic that they're gonna carry through. The other, so if you have people trying to buy and people trying to build, that's a good sign. I do think at the level that rates are at, you know, it is going to put a crimp on demand. One of the things I suspect, I can't prove entirely, but I suspect, is that we know that household formation had a huge boost from remote work. People wanted to live in didn't want to share apartment, stimulative effects too, and so you had this really high growth in household formation. I think interest rates have helped put that back that in the tube to a certain extent, but I think that pent-up demand is still there. And if we can get a balanced macro economy, which obviously remains to be seen, I think that's a good tailwind for building over the next few years, is that people want more space. They want houses. There are still people sort of with roommates who don't want to be there. And so this is why I'm sort of agreeing with the last bear. I don't see any sort of like great recession level shakeout coming. I think we could see weakness. We could see closures of building companies. We could see stress. We could see deals. We could see local areas that are dealing with something that looks like bubble aftermath. At the national level, I think modest levels of strain are the sort of, it should be the baseline scenario, not some major crisis.
Fair enough. I will say that Redfin recently noted that nearly, I think it was 15% of pending home sales in June actually fell through with people backing out. I think it translated to a little over 57,000 canceled contracts. But kind of to that credit of geographical location, a pretty high amount of that are in the Sunbelt cities like Jacksonville, Las Vegas. I think also Atlanta was pretty high on the list as well. But I do wonder if this is kind of a metric of homes being too expensive, or a metric of maybe consumers are projecting lower rates in the near future. I guess I don't have enough knowledge to deduce that, but it was an interesting statistic the Redfin CEO came out with. Bob, you had a comment there as well?
Well, I think one of the structural questions here with this economy is, are we going to see a pickup in credit, right, that can help offset some of the slowing that's occurring, particularly in the strength of the labor markets, maybe not in the tightness, but in the strength. And, you know, because if you look at real economy borrowing, it's still today at recession levels. And the question is basically, if we do start to get cuts, we've decided whether that's actually going to happen or not. But if we do start to see cuts, are we going to see an economic reacceleration? And I think it's important to recognize that that, you know, typically households don't engage in a bunch of mortgage equity withdrawal in an environment of falling house prices. They typically do it in an environment of rising house prices. And so unless buyers come to the market, or unless borrowers come to the market to take out that mortgage equity, they're not going to monetize the equity that they have in their houses today. Even though their equity is high, the falling prices are typically create aversion to withdrawing that equity. And so I think the falling prices that we're seeing, you know, look, I totally agree, we're not going to have like a 2006 to 8 crisis or anything like that, but my guess is it's enough to dissuade homeowners from doing that borrowing, to ramping up their borrowing. And that means that an important lever where there's a lot of equity in the market is probably off the table in terms of helping reaccelerate economic conditions, unless, you know, conditions slow a lot and there's a significant cut in rates, like, you know, down to 1% or something like that, like we saw in the 2002 cycle. So I think that's where the prices are really important when you're thinking about how could this economy play out ahead.
Thank you Bob, we've got about 6 minutes until Jay Powell takes the stand, but I really wanted to, at the last second here, I always do this, but I really wanted to touch a little bit on oil and its effects. So obviously oil prices are inflated again on Iran-Israel tensions. Brent traded near, I think, $78. There's some analysts warning that it could spike as high as 120 if conflict spreads. And so Fed Chair Powell has described on oil inflation as something that's noisy but important. And so I guess my question here, and Joseph, I'll pick on you to kind of send us off into the presser here. Should the Fed be explicitly including geopolitical energy risks in its policy models? And what kind of energy shock risk are we looking at?
Well, first off, I think you raised a really good point about oil prices, because we do have escalating geopolitical risk that the market doesn't seem to be acknowledging, right? So President Trump sent an ultimatum to President Putin and is raising the prospect of secondary sanctions, that is to say, I guess, trying to sanction other countries, third countries that are buying Russian oil, which I don't know if they're able to enforce that, but that could be very disruptive. So that seems to be driving oil prices higher, but other parts of the market aren't really concerned about that. It's really hard to model geopolitical risk. I listen to a lot of podcasts from people who specialize in geopolitics, and honestly, their hit rate isn't that great. Very interesting conversation, and I always listen to it anyway, but you know, it doesn't seem like something you could model. So I don't know if they could do any better. Maybe they could have some special communications information from people in the State Department or other foreign central banks, but it's a very difficult thing to model. It's very volatile. So I think that's why they like to exclude things like energy prices from their inflation metrics, looking at core PCE, because you know this geopolitical stuff could just blow over in a few days and oil prices will come right back down.
Thank you, Joseph. Bob, did you have a comment there? I don't know if it flashed your hand or not.
No, I was just laughing at Joseph saying geopolitical quote-unquote experts are pretty dog shit at actually making predictions. I appreciated that.
Well, to their hit rate, I mean, you and me both, brother. We only got about 3 minutes before I'm going to kick us over to Jay Powell. So everybody, as always, thank you so much for spending the formative years of your afternoon with us here at Unusual Whales. And obviously, Joseph, Bob, Last Bear, Adam, Marco, and Jem. If you're not following these folks, they are by far and beyond the biggest must-follows on any list I can imagine. The amount that I learn on these panels is just invaluable. I can't imagine any business or finance class getting as deep into the weeds as we get to here. I can't imagine you got the expertise in such a collaborative effort, even amongst the disagreements. I mean, everything I learn here is so good. So I can't thank you guys enough